Salutations, people of Earth. You're listening to The Bigfoot Show, episode number 51, released on the 22nd of June in the year of our Lord, 2013. I am, of course, your host, Brian Brown, coming to you this fine day from an undisclosed location. You know, whenever I post to our Facebook page that we're going to be recording a new show, and I ask our listeners there to suggest topics for us to discuss, one subject comes up again and again. Pretty much every time someone says they want to hear more about what's happening in Area X. Well, my friends, this is the show for you. What follows is more than 2 hours of Area X goodness. Much of it was recorded on location in the mountainous backwoods of eastern Oklahoma. As in the previous 2 years, the North American Wood Ape Conservancy, formerly known as the Texas Bigfoot Research Conservancy, is performing a continuous 3-month field study in their research area referred to as X. In 2011, this was called Operation Endurance. In 2012, it was Operation Persistence, and you can hear more about my experiences and the experiences of others in the NAWAC on episodes 38 and 39. This year, it's Operation Relentless, and it's happening right now. Up first in this episode is a conversation I had with NAWAC Chairman Alton Higgins and Kathy Strain, a United States Forest Service field anthropologist, noted author of Giants, Cannibals, and Monsters, Bigfoot Native Culture, and most impressively, I think, the all-time record holder for most Bigfoot show appearances. This is the Bigfoot show that is from the very pulsing nerve center of Area X, the epicenter of Area X. And I have with me Alton Higgins and Kathy Strain. And I'm excited because I realized when I was going to be down here this week that I was going to have a biologist and an anthropologist, two ists. And I thought it would be fun just to sort of talk about what we've experienced down here over the years and this year and just sort of get you guys' perspective on it. So I really don't have much of an agenda other than to do that. So I'm going to start with you, Alton, and ask you, we're in our third year of these sort of long-term summer operations. How would you say this one's been going so far?
Well, it's hard to compare years. I mean, you want activity, I guess, and there has been activity this year. We had a lot of activity last year, and so it's natural to compare years, and I think that's part of the dynamic that's going on here. From my perspective, I think that the main thing we need to keep in mind with regard to our activity here is that the apes are still in the vicinity and they are still expressing interest in our presence. And so whether or not there's as much, the level of activities are the same, the fact that there is activity and that the apes are here is what I think is important and what drives me to continue with the effort.
So what types of activity are you thinking is indicative of them being in the area?
Well, vocalizations is one category, I guess, and there have been a few possible vocalizations noted. Certainly the most distinctive for me, other than a sighting, is the act of throwing rocks. And we've had a fair amount of that activity just earlier today. We were asking the team that was on site for most of the day, you know, while we were gone for another responsibility. But while we were gone, they said that there were several distinctive rock throws during the day. If you count the evening and night hours, there were at least five distinctive rock throws noted by that group. So there's no other explanation for rocks, large rocks, hitting roofs other than either a human throwing them, and that was not the case here, or an ape throwing them.
And we've, you and I heard two of those this morning, both of them pretty clear, and one of them sounded like a very large rock being thrown. Kathy, you've only just arrived in this. And you're going to be here for quite a while. You're going to be here for several weeks. What do you hope to experience while you're here?
Well, I hope to have a sighting, of course, a visual, but what I hope to do is document behavior, whether it's with a sighting or not with a sighting, that can be attributed to their behavior, because we don't know an enormous amount about them, but we think they're very much ape-like, so I expect to see ape-like behavior and things that I can correlate with other known apes, and maybe tell me a little bit more of what their level of intelligence may be, what the interest in this area may be, maybe what their interest in us may be, so that we can better plan for future events, because this is a long-term study. And so every time we learn something, we can only make ourselves better by using that information to our advantage.
One of the things that we found this year that we've not found, what we found in the past is we have found boulders, and on top of those boulders, we have found the remains of hickory nuts. This year, we found in two separate locations boulders with the remains of hickory nuts, but also on those boulders, in one case at least, on top of the hickory nuts was another smaller rock, and it appeared that those nuts had been broken with the smaller rock on top of the boulder. Can you talk about, from an anthropological standpoint, the difference between using a rock to break a nut versus, some people might say that's evidence of tool use, and might use that to extrapolate their relative intelligence, you know. What does that tell you as an anthropologist, just seeing evidence of the use of a rock to do something like that?
Well, it's very intriguing because that is technically tool use. So taking a rock and using it in a method to crack something open, very much like an otter would use a rock to crack open a hard shell, is tool use. That's the very definition. It's not tool making, which shows a very a higher level of intelligence that is only attributed to really Homo sapiens sapiens. So, but it does tell me that they are capable of using something in their environment to their advantage. And up to this point, I don't believe that we have seen anything like that. So even chimps will, you know, take a twig and use it to help them get termites. And so it's very intriguing to do that. And the other important thing that I saw that I've been mulling over all day was finding firewood that belonged to camp located a distance away. And it appears to have been used to strike another tree to create wood knocking. That to me is even more intriguing, because to me what that means is they recognize something from our camp that was beneficial to them that they could not find in the natural environment. So they found a piece of firewood more attractive than they would a branch or other piece of material out in the landscape. And so that's very, very indicative of something smart. Maybe not our level of smart, but still very intelligent.
Right. The difference between a piece of firewood and a piece of just wood in the forest is that it's been dried. It's all hardwood for the most part. Our firewood is hardwood. Alton, you and I yesterday found one of, and we found one of those before. We found one of those in the past. We found another one. This was even further east, away from our location. Just tell me what you think about that, and tell me what you did after we found that, just to sort of figure out where this could have come from.
Well, we found, was it last year, I think, when we had all the teams? No, it was the year before. Yeah, the year before last year, Operators in Endurance, we had a number of teams that reported hearing very loud clear wood knocks that seemed to originate within the area of the cabins. I mean, very, very close. And team after team reported this, and they indicated the same direction. And as we've discussed before, we found by accident, we stumbled across this piece of firewood that was located, you know, next to a tree and a rock that when struck created the same sounds that these teams had been reporting for so many weeks. And so we had that in our heads as far as the idea of firewood with squared off ends and a certain length, and that's just kind of part of what we, you know, had in our awareness. And when we were on this hike, we were far to the east, hundreds of yards anyway. I don't know exactly how far. We'll have to figure that out later. But hundreds of yards east of the farthest east cabin. And again, we found a piece of firewood. This was a piece of hardwood that was located next to a tree, and it had every appearance of having been used. It was broken. Like a part of it was broken off, and it looked like maybe it was a result of being hit against a rock or a tree, and it formed kind of a nice handle for a human-sized hand. But I don't think that it was, you know, shaped like that so that an ape could grab it easier. I think it just broke. And the other end of it, there was a circular indentation, a mark that looked like it was the result of an impact with something hard, either a hard bark tree or a rock perhaps. And part of what that indicated to me was the idea that they may use wood knocking as a way of communicating among themselves, not just, you know, as an intimidation thing or whatever else we may have speculated with regard to, you know, why do they exhibit this behavior. The fact that we heard it, you know, we found that piece of firewood in a place where we here at the camp would not have heard it, suggests to me that it was used for communication among themselves. After we got back to camp, behind my tent and your tent is a little path, and right behind my tent, our tents, just, I don't know, was it even 20 feet, something like that, maybe less than that, 12 feet or so. Anyway, we saw right in the path a piece of firewood. This was pine. It had the bark on it, so it was distinctly pine. And that was a great mystery, because we hadn't seen pine used as firewood around here. And we checked all of the places where there's firewood around here, and all of it is hardwood. And so this was, you know, squared off in the ends, cut, you know, fire piece or firewood length wood. And I have no idea what to suggest for where that came from, but it was not there when we were here, when we arrived.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing for me, is that we had been through that area multiple times, and as you alluded to, we're sort of like looking for firewood where it doesn't belong, and we're sort of being very careful about where we put firewood so that we don't accidentally get ourselves excited about something. And this piece of firewood was clearly sitting in this trail, and we did not put it there, and it had not been there. So previous to that, we had heard some sort of thudding sound. This is something that we've heard here on occasion from time to time, different types of thuds, but some sort of like impact sound of the ground, sort of a deep sound. You almost feel as much as you hear. And we had heard something from that direction, and that was in between the time that we had been in that area and found the wood. So it's conceivable, you can speculate, that wood had been chucked or something along those lines.
We tested that idea too with that very piece of wood. I mean, you threw it up in the air, and when it landed, it recreated this sound that sounded just like what, you know, all the team had heard earlier in that same direction. You know, we heard this thud of something, you know, we speculated at the time it sounded like a rock hitting, you know, damp earth or something. But when you threw that up in the air and it landed, I mean, it created the same sound from the same direction. So, I mean, it makes perfect sense to me that it was that same piece of wood. We can talk about the log stick thing.
Yeah, let's talk. Yeah, so the other piece of evidence that sort of brings us to think there may have been something walking back there is there was a piece of wood on the ground. And tell us what you saw in that wood.
Yeah, it was lying across the path. It was near the piece of firewood. It was about a couple of inches or so in diameter. It was just a stick that had fallen from a tree, and it was kind of partially rotted. It was not rotted to the point where if you messed with it, it just fell apart. You know, it was still fairly firm, but if you stood on it, it kind of compressed a little. But there was an 8-inch section of it that was just absolutely smashed, and it would have taken a great deal of weight, I believe, to have done that. And, you know, many of us stood on that piece of wood, stomped on that piece of wood with one foot, and like I say, we just compressed it. And even after we'd done that probably 20 times or so, the wood still hadn't broken. So I'm fairly confident, you know, based on those observations and what happened with Jeff, that maybe something, you know, a creature, an ape, had walked up behind our camp during the night.
The interesting bit about timing around that is that we had, when we arrived, it was raining very, very hard. So we didn't pitch our tents the first night. We actually slept in one of the cabins. And then, so the night that potentially this happened was the first night that you had been in the tents over near that little trail. With regard to the different sort of texture of activity, I don't want to say there's been less activity, because we still sense activity, we still hear things, but there seems to be a different texture to the way they're interacting. there may be environmental reasons for that. There may be other reasons. So, Kathy, from your standpoint, can you speculate as why would do you believe the types of activity that we're experiencing, the level of activity we're experiencing, what are reasons why that might be different this year versus last or the year before that?
Well, you know, this is only year three into a study, so it's you're on average. You know, it's difficult to say what is less or more because it's going to ebb and flow based on that. But so far, we're now halfway through, and we haven't seen the frenzied behavior that I called it from last year, where their curiosity drove them to do some very bold things, where they wanted to have that contact with us. And so far, nothing that we have seen has risen to that level of frenzied behavior. And so I think there may be a lot of different factors. We have a late spring. We have lots of water available. We have done one thing new with this new system that we've put in. So any combination of that can lead to disruption. It could be that their birthing cycle is not known to us, and that maybe it runs every 2 years, and now there's infants involved that may not make them inclined to be any closer to us than what they've been doing. So there's all kinds of unknown unknowns that we probably will never know, and so it's hard to hypothesize because we're not going to be able to know. But I think the team makeup has been pretty even from the years before. I think we're seeing the same people return. This year we have a little more females on one team. Yeah.
Some of the teams have been bigger this year, so there were more people. But I don't know that that's necessarily a... The problem that we have here, in the analogy I use, is that we have a jigsaw puzzle and all of the pieces are the same color. And we're in a room with no light trying to put this together. And so all we have are the observations that we have, and then all the time in between the observations trying to figure out why we're observing what we're observing. And
Well, I think that's important to note that Jane Goodall was in contact with the chimps for many years before she even tried to hypothesize what the behavior made. All she was doing was reporting, this is what happened, this was the result, blah, blah, blah. It's X to Y to Z. Didn't have any speculation. And so we seem to have this need to want to try to explain everything with very little data. And we really have to be careful with that, because what we observe now and what our thought process of why that happened in 5 years may be very, very different. And much like I like to use that Neanderthal example, where we have one set of bones, it ended up being an older man who was crippled. And so, but for years, because that was the one example we had, our viewpoint of Neanderthal was tainted as being slow, stupid, hunched over, when that couldn't have been further from the truth. And so we want to be very careful, you know, what we do know and what we can say without doubt, that they're an animal. They're a wild animal. There does not appear any ability for them to make tools. So not use tools, but make tools that would put them in a higher level, maybe in the Homo genus. We know that they use their environment to their advantage. We know that there's plenty of resources here. We know there's plenty of water here, and we know that they want to be here for some reason. And we know that there's more than one. Other than that, there's probably not a lot of facts that we can add to that. We know they knock wood sometimes, they clack rocks sometimes, they throw rocks seemingly a lot of time. What does any of that mean? Does it mean they want us out, or they want us to come out and play, or it has nothing to do with us? They just like the sound of rock on metal, and they giggle and think that's funny. I mean, we don't know. This may go on when we're not even here. Right. And so we have no way of knowing that information.
Alton, one of the things we've done as a group is try to sort of categorize the things that we know, the observable facts that we know, versus the things that are sort of in the realm of speculation, and then the things that we just don't have any idea about. So with regard to all of what we're talking about, how does that influence how you approach this, and how do you think it should influence how we as an organization approached our work here?
Well, I think the main thing is to record what we observe, what we experience, not to try to impute any kind of motives or to humanize the creatures or, you know, do anything like that. Just be as objective as possible record what we do, record what we observe, and try to do the best that we can to use our limited store of knowledge to try to improve our chances for obtaining, you know, more documentation.
Well, and I guess my viewpoint would be that we continue doing what we're doing, and you know, some, I know there's a lot of speculation when we should go big and bold and do, you know, this crazy scheme over here or this crazy scheme over here. But really, we know, at least through the first 2 years of study, that just being here, just being ourselves, has caused some interaction. And so I think we are to stay the course of doing what we're doing and not try to just, well, we haven't tried this crazy scheme yet or this or this, because it may change behavior, it may desensitize them, it may overly sensitize them. And so we know that just being us, walking around, making observations at this point has been successful, so we need to continue doing that same method.
Well, you know, I think that, I mean, I'm in the organization and I see it from the inside, but I think that in my mind, we kind of have an internal dynamic that on one hand we feel very strongly that a specimen needs to be collected so this animal can be shown to be real, so that the work of conservation and study can really go forth in a huge way. But we're also trying to gather this data. So you have sort of these conflicting drives in our work here. And it just seems to me that there's a certain level of frustration, because on one hand, collecting a specimen is a finite, you know, objective. It can happen. That when it happens, it'll be obvious that it happens. Whereas the collection of data just goes on and on and on, and then you have to analyze the data and everything else. Not really sure where I'm going with that. I'm just making the observation that we kind of have two competing desires when we come in here. The group sitting here now, our team, is primarily looking for data, looking to collect information. But we've had other teams that are much more involved in sort of the other side of the mission, which is the collection of a type specimen. One of the things that we've talked about amongst ourselves is this idea that what happens after if we're the ones, what happens after the species is proven, whether it happens here or elsewhere, and how does that influence our organization's future? And as the chairman of the group, what are your thoughts? I mean, there's a lot of people that in the community, in the Bigfoot community, who have this idea that we will be sort of a critical player in that, we being everybody in the Bigfoot community. But what's your point of view on this idea of, like, after the animal is proven, what is the role of groups like ours and others?
Well, that's another speculative area. I think that subsequent to documentation, you're going to have federal agencies, you're going to have private organizations, you're going to have just a lot of focused energy that's going to be outside of our control. Certainly, the fact that we have years of observational data, I think, will be of interest to them. I think the interpretation and use of that, you know, we'll turn it over. You know, we're collecting data for the scientific community. Whatever we collect, that's going to be made available to the scientific community. Whether or not we're involved as an organization is something that is outside of our control. So I frankly don't really worry about it much or dwell upon it. I think that our primary objective is to achieve documentation. And along the way, I don't see them as contradictory, to collect as much information as we can regarding, you know, hows and whens and whats and, you know, in terms of our activities. People that have different perspectives, I think, when they look at all that kind of data, will come up with things that we might not have considered. So our job is not so much interpretive as collecting, and our role will be out of our hands. Hopefully we'll have some kind of involvement in, you know, subsequent years in terms of, you know, trying to express to you know, academicians, the primatologist, whoever it is that ends up responsible for the follow-up research that will entail, I'm convinced, you know, a huge amount of energy, resources, time. The questions that come from the documentation of the species will be endless. And probably the first one is, where does this species live? And that, just by itself, the distribution and abundance question, that's going to be, you know, a primary focus. I think that once the documentation is achieved, that the species will be declared an endangered species. I think it's the Secretary of the Interior that has the prerogative to do that, and that'll provide some time then for scientists to address this distribution and abundance question and habitat requirements and all that. And, you know, we may be involved with that, and other groups may be involved with that. It would make sense to me that they would look at the databases of some of the organizations besides ours that are out there, since we have a regional focus. But whether or not they engage individuals in those organizations as advisors, to me, I kind of doubt it.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing about the endangered species declaration is it isn't necessarily because we know them to be endangered, just because that sort of freezes the table and nothing else can happen, you know, until that determination is made. Do you have anything you want to add to that?
Well, it just is, I think what we're doing is providing the baseline data, and that's, I got to emphasize, data. We're not going to be providing baseline analysis or baseline, this is what we think, you know, these monkeys are doing out here. It's the baseline data. We are excellent at taking raw notes and turning them into just factual sheets that can easily be turned over to, you know, if it's Fish and Wildlife Service or whoever would be leading the charge of that. And I think that will provide them important information, because at that time of discovery, you're going to have everything in the world coming out of the woodwork going, they're telepathic, they are here from aliens, and I think our documentation clearly proves that they're flesh and blood, that they're clearly not capable of reading our minds or, you know, making us, you know, telepathically do things. And so I think that will help them rule out some of that stuff that they can just go, no, thank you, have a nice day, and just push it out of the way. But, you know, I'm
pretty sure a psychic monkey made me drive my truck through a creek that was too high the other day.
I'm very sure. I kept thinking to myself, Brian, why did you do that? And I thought, he was told, you know, to do it. It was the monkeys doing it. Yeah, but, yeah, and I think that they would be declared an endangered species right off the bat, and it would allow at least, in my mind, a 20 to 25-year time period to do that research in order to protect their habitat. It would protect them from hunting. It would protect them from maybe some of their habitat being destroyed by unnecessary means. And so, it will be, you know, a rude shock to a lot of industries and a lot of other individuals, but I think in the end it'll all be for the benefit. But you know, it's pretty exciting to me that is a potential out there, because many times you're out when you're just by yourself, you don't see the benefit of you being out there for 10 days and sweating it out and really having nothing happen. And here you can really see the benefit that the greater cause, you're contributing to that.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, we're a conservation group. So ultimately, we're trying to make sure that their habitat is preserved so that they can be preserved. And so everything we do should be focused on that. And that's what's most exciting to me, is that after the animal is established, then that act of conservation, the work of conservation, can take place. And that will make what happened with the spotted owl look like, you know, a birthday party. But the other thing I notice as I'm sitting here with you guys is that, Alton, you've been coming in here more or longer than anyone in our organization. And, Kathy, you were here with me when we had our sighting last year, which I've talked about on the show, but only from my perspective. And now you're here. So what I'd like to do is sort of get to a sort of transition to kind of a conversation about experiences. Alton, can you sort of give us a quick version of how did we end up here? How did this place become, or how did it show up on our radar?
Well, it was recommended that we, excuse me.
Small break. Do, 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 do.
Monkeys made him a cow.
Monkeys. So.
It's a monkey cow.
I was in the BFRO at the time, and a fellow member and I came to this region. I was interested in some spots that I'd found on topo maps, and we, by pure luck, I think, ran into a Forest Service supervisor who was retired, and he'd had these creatures on his property. And in visiting with him, he started out to show us, you know, how to get to the place I was wanting to get to. But there's so many roads out there, Forest Service roads, that don't show up on any maps. It was really confusing. So I asked him, you know, if it was up to you, where would you go? And so he told us about this place and said, you know, I think I can arrange for a guide to show you how to get in there. And on that first trip, I was fortunate enough to find a trackway, a really good trackway. It was in dried mud, 16-inch tracks. Paralleling the tracks was a set of bear tracks, large and then small. And so that's what started. And then I started talking to people that owned property here, and those that, you know, had long experience with this area that were related to family members and what have you. And so we organized an expedition or two, a couple of expeditions when I was with the BFRO, and we came in here and just had some experiences that reconfirmed in my mind that this was a place where the species could be found. And so then when I joined the TBRC, now the NAWAC, we were looking for areas to put camera traps. And so we came in here with the Operation Forest Vigil and had cameras in here for a number of years. We didn't get any photos, but, you know, we became convinced that the species was here. You know, we were already convinced that's why we were here, but, you know, we decided to take a different tack and employ a longer range strategy, on-site strategy. So that's what we're doing now.
Why do we not disclose the location? From an organizational standpoint, why do we not just basically put a big red X on a map and tell everybody where it is? Why do we try to keep this place sort of to ourselves for as long as we can?
Well, you want to control as many variables as possible when you're doing anything, you know, from a scientific perspective. And one variable we do not want to have to mess with is that of other people. And so that's our primary concern. We want to know that the things that we're observing and documenting are the result of native species of animal, and that they're not the result of people coming in here. And this is an area that's very difficult to reach. And it's a beautiful, pristine area, and it's, you know, we're blessed to be able to come here and observe, document in an unspoiled place.
And I'm thinking specifically about the rocks that we found, the boulder and the nuts and the little crushing rock, if that's what it is. The only way that could be used in the way that it appears to have been used. I mean, there's, as I said before, there's a boulder, there are remains of nuts, and on top of that there is a rock. And so the nuts are under the rock and around the rock. So you can sit there and look at that all day long, and you cannot come up with a way that without the intervention of some kind of animal, those things came to be organized that way. It can't be explained by anything that I can think of, and I've spent a lot of time thinking about it. So therefore, if it is as it appears that the rock was being used to crush the nuts, you need to have an animal that can hold a rock. And so humans can hold rocks, and so presumably can wood apes. So we need to be able to know that there aren't people in here setting up these things for us to find. Now, it's interesting that we've been finding these boulders with nuts on them for many years. So this isn't the first time we've seen this. It is the first time we've seen it with the little pounding rock in place. But I would imagine that's another thing we need to be sort of cognizant of. Over the time, you've been coming in here now for how long has it been?
13 years.
13 years? What are just one or two of the, or three or eight, of the sort of interesting experiences you've had in here over that time?
Well, I think I've mentioned before about, you know, hearing rocks hitting buildings. Unless unless you experience that, you can't imagine the adrenaline rush that that produces when you know positively that a rock hit a building or a rock was thrown at you from this steep mountainside that's right behind us, and that people are not involved. I mean, that's an incredible rush, but it's also, a great confirmation that you're in the right place and that there are, you know, there's an undiscovered, undocumented species in the neighborhood. Unless you see this place, you can't really appreciate, you know, how rugged it is, how dangerous it is, how difficult it is to get around, how thick the vegetation is, and how terrible the visibility is here. You know, animals can be extremely close to you, and then they just take a few steps and they seemingly disappear. You know, we've seen this happen with deer, bear, and these creatures. It's hard for people that don't get out in this kind of habitat very much to really appreciate the extreme difficulty of the task that we face here. But so that's part and parcel of it too, I guess, is being able to just be in this place. I've don't know how many people I've heard talk about how this is a magical place. It, like I said, it can be hot and miserable. It's filled with ticks and greenbrier and horrible dangers, but at the same time, it's beautiful, and it's just a majestic place. And when you're here, you know, it's almost like you feel like you're back in time or something, because you see no human, I mean, other than around the cabin, you see no indication of human presence. There's no garbage. There's no trash. There doesn't seem to be jets flying overhead. I mean, it's a very quiet place. You're just in the middle of an area that almost like being dropped into the Pleistocene or something, it seems.
I was mentioning yesterday that you spend a week in here and you sort of get to the point where you're ready to go, right? And you're ready to go home, and you load your stuff in your car or your truck and you get out, and a day and a half after you get home, you're like, I wonder what's going on down there, you know, and you want to go back there again. I was convinced you were going to say about the time just like 3 feet behind me when you fell off the roof and broke your leg, but maybe you can talk about that some other time.
That was memorable, but I wouldn't say it was a pleasant memory. That's related to the rocks, of course. We've talked about this in other broadcasts, but yeah, I mean, the rock thing is that's one of their favorite behaviors, it seems. I don't know why they do it. We've noted coincidence in terms of rock-thrown events and our comings and goings. So, I mean, it seems that there's something, you know, pertinent along those lines. I don't know if they do it for fun or what it is, because, you know, we've had these things that the guys call rock wars where we trade, you know, we're throwing up into this green abyss behind us. And, well, I guess an abyss is a hole. Anyway, this green wall behind us, you know, they're throwing rocks up there and rocks coming back out of it. So I don't know if that's play or what that is, but, you know, we know that they do it. And so that's a memorable thing. And I was up on the roof, you know, collecting the rocks for whatever reason. You know, I guess Jimmy Chilcutt told us that he didn't think it was possible to secure DNA from rocks, but maybe we can sell them as, you know, souvenirs or something. A wood ape threw this rock, you know.
Like a keychain, and we'll stamp our logo on it. So Kathy, we're very close to the area that we had our sighting last year, and anyone who's listened to the podcast, I think it was episode 38, has heard my recounting of that, but you were here too. And if I had the worst view of what we saw, you had the best view. So could you sort of relate the Reader's Digest version, or just what did you see, and what sticks with you today? And this is, I think, the first time you've been back since that time. Just what are your feelings about it now, just a little over a year later?
Well, I did have the best view. I was facing, and it's that whole, you know, the beforehand kind of log thing that we don't need to go back over. But what I saw was very distinctly two individuals walking towards us, and I wasn't paying as much attention to the small one as I was the big one. And it just seemed like they were oblivious that we were there, and they were trying to find a place to go up the mountain that to get to safety. And we could hear their rustling of their feet at first, and then they broke out into the open completely, like I said, oblivious to us being there. And I jumped up and said, "There they are," and then I ran towards them. And my actions caused them to then bolt up the hillside to get away from us. And, you know, of course, in hindsight, I wish I had just let them see how close they were going to get to us before it dawned on them that we were sitting there. But my attention then focused almost immediately when I realized what I was seeing to the big one, because it was larger, I felt like I could get more details from their body type, what they look like, how they were going to move, than I could the small one. And so what I saw was what appeared to be they were so quick, that's what kind of took my breath away, that they went up the hillside like they had been ripped up on a bungee cord. And the big one took its arms and tucked it into its sides, much like what I would envision a power runner going up a hill would do, and was pumping them, not on all fours, nothing like that, not swinging. It was very tight to their chest. I envisioned that they were doing that because of breaking through vines and using their forearms to crush through it. And then it turned its feet to walk duck-like, but not like webbing or anything like that, but just turned its feet to the side in order to get better grip going up the hill. And so much to my surprise, I mean, I really expected that more classic tightrope type walking that's talked about often, but this was definitely not that. This was I'm going to get up that mountainside as fast as I can possibly get, and it was just like lightning going up the hillside. And you know, and then there was other action after that. There was actually, it was quite a busy week. But being back here now, I mean, I feel still very blessed that I had that experience, but also very enthralled that maybe I can have something like that again. Because initially, I think the whole setup of why that happened was that they were very curious. I have a high female voice, and I can't help but wonder if that wasn't something unusual that they heard, that there was like, what in the world is that horrible scratchy noise? Make it stop. God, make it stop. And they were trying to come in to smother me with a pillow or something. But hopefully we can use that kind of intrigue to bring them back in again to make an observation. But it also made me realize that they can easily lose track of us, because they should have known where we were sitting, but they were oblivious to it. So they clearly had lost track of where we were. And so I just think that that's probably happens more often than not, where they think X and it's really Y going on, and that's why those encounters happen, because they're not intentional. I mean, if they had had their way, they would like to rewind that and go, oops, you know, we're not going to have public.
I can't think of any of the encounters we've had here where it seemed obvious that the animal wanted to be seen. There have been, on occasions, the animals reacted in a way that made it seem like it didn't mind that it was seen, but those seem to be very specifically around certain individuals. Others have been, you know, very active to get away as quickly as possible. Well, the distraction thing is interesting to me, the fact that they didn't know we were there, even though we weren't that far away. We had been moving around quite a bit prior to that, and we had just sort of come back to our sort of base camp. You had an observation specifically around how they were moving that may help explain why they were not as focused on us as they may have been, the sort of the weaving thing. Can you sort of speak to that? In the few seconds you had seen them, what did you observe them doing?
Well, what it looked like what was happening is the big one was trying to break to go up the hillside, and the little one kept going forward. And so the big one would go, what? And then try to catch up with the little one and go, we're going this direction, much like a mother would try to coach their child, you need to come with me now. And the child wasn't willing to do so. And so that's how it appeared, was like, okay, let's go. No, okay, you're not coming. All right, come on, let's go. Oh, come on, let's go. And it wasn't until I said, oh my God, there they are, that they both became in tune with each other and they both went, boom. But even then, they didn't go the same path as each other. And so the big one went up first without regard to the little one at all. And the little one, I don't think, followed exactly the same path. But I'm not sure of that, because, like I said, I was totally focused on the big one. It really, even though I have no reason to base it on, it really felt like mother and child. It did not have the appearance of a father who would have, in my opinion, been a little more forceful in directing that child and where it wanted to go. And so it was kind of more of a mother with a precocious little one who was curious but unaware that there was maybe danger just another 5 feet. So, oh, the big one was huge. We put Mark McClurkin, who is about 6'3" and you know,
big boy,
yeah. Up on the hillside, and I stood in my perspective, and the big one dwarfed him. And the little one was roughly half that size. And when you say little one, you're thinking, you know, a foot tall, you know, but it's really not, at least 3 to 4 foot tall. And I'm sure up against me, because I'm not that tall, it would have been, you know, just slightly smaller than us. But it was completely black. Face was black. There was no other color that was represented. And it was pure, you know, daylight. In fact, it was not all that much from where we're talking now. And you can see how well you can see out into the forest. But, you know, it was, I think for me, the reason why I think it was so powerful was it wasn't what I expected. Mm-hmm. You know, I really was expecting the slow-mo, Patty.
Right.
Dun, 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 right. You know, and I had all the time in the world to observe it and all that. And it was so quick, it kind of reinforced that, oh, that's why people say, well, I didn't have time to react. Right. And then for me, even though I'm a professional and I came here to see one, my reaction to it was very not what I expected of myself. I really lost my cool. I was really kind of like, ah! You know, like, okay, honey, it's time to go home now. And I've had enough. And I had a slight meltdown because I had to get that stress out of me that where before, or I was going to have a panic attack or something, because it was not what I expected. And I think, I don't, and again, what I expected was Patty. I expected her to I guess, stroll through camp, give me, you know, half an hour to photograph her in various positions.
Well, it's, you know, the freaking out thing, at least for me, because I think we were all pretty affected by what we had seen. But I kept going on about this in the show when I talked about it, but the speed of the thing was just, it just mind-blowing. And it's interesting you say that I expected it to look like Patty, because we have another member who had a sighting early on this year, and he didn't process what he was seeing at first, because he said he always thought he would see Patty. And it seems that image is almost to our detriment now, because we all expect it's going to be the Patterson-Gilman subject. And a lot of them that we see here, you know, the three or four that we've seen, perhaps, they don't fit into that.
But they do in a way. I mean, they do in a way, but just not to the size, I think. I mean, you can tell somebody all you want to that something's 8 foot tall and weighs 500 pounds, but until you see what that looks like, you don't have a perspective of what that's supposed to look like. And I've grown up in the forest. I've seen bear. I've seen everything. And when I see a bear, I know when I see a bear. If I see a coyote, I know when I see a coyote. And this didn't fit my image of what I was expecting.
And if you compare and contrast to the Patterson-Gilman subject, which I believe anyone who listens to this show knows that I think that this is a genuine film of a genuine animal. We've got, as an organization, have photos we've collected from other parts of Oklahoma that seem to show an animal that looked like Patty. The gray one that we've seen here, the bits of it that we have seen look very much like Patty. That animal looks more like Patty than any others. So now what you have is just a collection of different body types. You have different types of reaction. So if now Patty is genuine, her lack of alacrity, you know, in getting away from Patterson and Gimlin, all you're left with is, this is the observation. We cannot say why Patty didn't bolt, like, you know, didn't jump and move as quickly as we've observed them moving here. The gray one doesn't either. So you're just left with...
Yeah, it behaves indifferently when it has been observed, it seems.
Right. And the question, you know, so why, people ask, we don't know.
Well, and in the end, what we're going to hopefully be documenting is, because we're documenting time of day, time of year, season, conditions, what we saw, what color was it, the height, whatever. In at some point, we're going to be able then to put male, female, age, other thing going on, and it may be what we see in the end is genders act differently, situations act, who else is also present. Maybe the gray man acts differently because he knows or she knows that she's got four others in the sidelines. And so there's all these things that we can only speculate, which we shouldn't do. We're just recording the data. And at some point, it will make sense and it will all come together because somebody will see the other half that we're not seeing.
That's the best and clearest view of the gray one we've had here was later in the season, and Patty was filmed in October. And it's interesting to me that those are late in season. It's, you know, animals, a lot of animals put on a lot of weight over the summer when the food is plentiful. So that's just another, like, possibility that...
They getting fat and lazy, is that what you're saying?
Well, they just get fat because they're going to be cold and there's not going to be a lot of food. So, you just need more observation. It would be great if we could get a great view of the gray one in May.
Well, it'd be great if we could be here literally year round. If we could have, you know, somebody here 365 days a year, we would then be able to tell what goes on when we're not here, because we don't have any clue. For all they know, they sit at the table and play poker, you know, and rummage through all our stuff. But and that was an observation that I wanted to make before, was why the firewood is so important to me. Is because there are items that they can take at any time, including food, and that has not happened. And so, why firewood? When I have my choice of meat or free food, vegetables, fruit, all this stuff, none of that stuff has ever been disturbed, which is what you'd expect with bear behavior, of course. But instead, they're choosing to take firewood, which to us is a throwaway nothing item. And so it adds a perspective of what they consider valuable, that they're not interested in metal items, they're not interested in tools that we already have produced, or mirrors or any of that items, and so it's very curious.
We had an experience earlier in the operation that I'll just say, there was activity near our woodshed, and what we heard was the sound of the metal corrugated roof being sort of messed with. But when we found, and so we assumed that it was messing with it for the purpose of messing with it, just to hear the sound. But then when we found that firewood, it sort of changed our perspective on what may have been happening over there.
Yeah, it probably indicated that the firewood was the objective, and the sound, I think, was secondary to that. I don't think they went over there to rub the sheet of a corrugated tin back and forth. There was a loose sheet up there. You can rub it back and forth and make a really loud noise. I don't think they were there to make noise. I think that was incidental to their primary objective, which is to snag themselves a good piece of firewood.
Right. So, I mean, a lot of this, in my mind, and again, anyone who listens to the show knows my point of view on this, but all of this to me ties back. We have so many questions, and we have remarkably little actual data and practically no answers whatsoever. And the only way the data and the answers will come about is with concerted study, with 24/7, 365 study of these animals, where they live. And that won't happen until they're proven to exist. So for me, all of this just ties back neatly into a little package for us.
Yeah. I was going to say, you asked earlier what was one of my favorite memories, and Kathy's comments about her sighting made me think that, or reminded me that one of my favorite things is seeing the reactions of other people when they come here. You can't guarantee that anything will ever happen or that any one person will have something happen, but over the years, it's been terrific to bring in people. Well, like you, you know, we brought you in here and you saw and experienced things that... you probably never would have imagined. And I remember John Mayansinski, we brought him in here, and he had some really neat observations and experiences, and you know, Kathy, and seeing that change. I mean, it's very different when you have like one person who makes outlandish claims and they keep going and coming back and going and coming back and saying, you know, I have this, I've seen this, you know. When you're bringing in lots of people who you trust and who you have confidence in, like, you know, Mayansinski, yourself, you know, Kathy and Bob Strain, they were brought in here and they were able to confirm, you know, for themselves at least, if, you know, certainly hasn't convinced the scientific community, but it's a great joy to see the people observing and experiencing the same things that we've been saying and seeing.
I mean, we're upwards of a dozen people who have had really compelling experiences down here. Yeah, sightings, like actual, like I saw a big hairy monkey. And I know they're not monkeys. All right. Well, thanks, guys, for sitting down. I know, Alton, you're getting ready to bug out, and Kathy, you're just getting ready to settle in here. So I appreciate this little nexus of the time that you're both available.
It's great being with you.
I know. Awesome.
We've known each other since 99, I think we figured out, probably for 4 years. We were like BFRO friends, you know, communicating with each other through the investigator and curator forums. And we met in 2003, and it's just been great to be able to see her again. Was it last year you were at her house?
Oh, yeah, last year. Yeah, we stayed with you before we came in last year.
Okay. Well, anyway, awesome to see her again and be here with her.
Well, thank you guys very much, and thanks for talking to me. Next up, it's Kathy again, along with Monica Rollins. They were talking to me one dark night as we sat around a campfire waiting for those pesky wood apes to make themselves known. You're going to hear us make mention of various things during this interview that were happening around us, but you won't be able to hear them yourself due to the type of microphone I was using. In fact, I had headphones on, and I could only hear what was recording, so I didn't hear any of it as it happened either. You can only barely make out the nice fire we had going and all of its popping and crackling. So anyway, here's Kathy and Monica. Okay, so now it's a few days after my conversation with Kathy and Alton, and we're actually are in the middle of actual Bigfooting at this point, aren't we?
Yes.
So we've had, it's funny, we were talking about how the activity was kind of low on the last conversation, and now we've actually had some interesting activity, and so I thought it would be a good opportunity now to talk to Kathy Strain again and Monica Rollins. We're the only three here right now. We've had a larger crew, but two of them have left today, so it's just the three of us, and we're sitting around a campfire, and so I thought we'd have a conversation. So why don't I start with Kathy? So, Kathy, what's happened the past couple of days? How would you characterize the activity that's happened around us?
Well, it's been very active. We've had lots of rock throws, lots of appearing to want to be close to us and observe what we're doing. We've had at least what I would call a primate display of out of anger, or, you know, the need to show that we have a dominant male in this area. So it's been kind of very exciting and a little intimidating all at the same time, but I'm enjoying it because it's behavior that needs to be recorded, and so I'm excited to be here to see it firsthand.
Monica, it's been a while since you were in X. When's the last time you were here?
Oh, I think it was January of 2010.
Okay. So what do you think? What are your impressions of it thus far?
I am very impressed with the increased activity, because the last time I was here, there really wasn't much going on. And we would always, when we would come in, whether mostly in the summers, we would hear what we assumed were nuts hitting the roof of this place we're at now. And seeing that that's leading to more and more activity in this area is very interesting. And, you know, it also says that there was probably always activity on this side of the property that we were just completely unaware of.
So you were here during, was it the camera trap operation? Is that the last time you were here?
Yes. Yes.
So, Kathy, the other night, one of the first notable things that I'm remembering off the top of my head that happened is we're sitting around a campfire ring that's maybe 30 or 40 yards from where my truck is parked, and my truck is parked up against the woods, and you saw something over there. Can you describe what you saw behind my truck?
Yes. We have a pretty large fire going almost every night, and I was looking towards your truck, and the only light was the fire. I think there may have been the lantern that was on, and I saw two two orange eyes that were perfectly round, that was looking at me from it was switched the other direction. No, it was the same way. So looking from, obviously on the driver's side, looking at me, and I could see it through the passenger window, and it looked at me, it looked away, then it looked back at, or not me in particular, I guess more like at the fire, and the firelight was catching its eye shine. And then I saw it lower, like it was going to move, and then we heard a something big move off into the brush very suddenly.
And that's those aren't reflections, because I'm looking at my truck then and now, and the fire is not reflecting in the window, so that's not what that was. So What's interesting about that is we've had some of the other members who were here perceived what they thought was motion. Monica, did you see some movement back there? Okay, so it must have been one of the other girls that was here. Thought that they saw some movement back there. And also last night, I was going to, my tent is pitched over there, and I was going to go into my tent. And as I walked over towards my truck, I heard from behind the truck, in the woods right behind my truck, three loud, sort of very discernible footsteps. Sort of crunch, 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 moving away from me as I was walking over there. And so I put everything down and lit up the area, and I told everyone what I had heard. And it took a while for them to come over, maybe, I don't know, 20 seconds. And as I was sort of moving around the woods over there, I could continue to hear something in there moving further away. But I also heard what I can only describe as like a gibbering whispering, a sort of a kind of weird ass sound that I've never heard before in my life. So that was weird. Monica, you also heard some interesting sounds last night, not too long after that. What were those like?
Well, it was very interesting, and it caught me off guard as I was collecting my things from my tent. I turned around to walk back to the cabin, and I could have sworn I heard from a very low garbled whisper, probably similar to what you heard. And it was, it sounds weird. I mean, it's not something you expect to hear, you know, while you're trying to get into a cabin from a tent. So.
Well, there's all kinds of sounds that happen out here, and you get used to the ones that are, you know, quote unquote normal. And then when something new comes along. So one of the things that we had experimented with, and if anyone who's listened to this show for a while knows that the NAWAC recorded some vocalizations a couple of years ago during Operation Endurance that sounded, to those of us who've listened to it, not unlike the Sierra sounds. So one of the things that we had talked about doing last night was actually call blasting part of the Sierra sounds. And it's Sierra Sound Vocalization 1 is the one that we were using. It's the one that the people on the Sierra Sounds think that is a female. We picked it because we thought it was the least aggressive, but in listening to it, maybe we were wrong about that, especially in light of what happened. So we had sent that out, and we had decided to go to bed. The first time we decided to go to bed was when the thing walked behind the truck, that sound. That got us kind of riled up for about another hour or so. Then we're like, okay, this time we're really going to go to bed. And even though part of it happened to me, you're tired of listening to my voice, I'm going to have Kathy describe what happened next.
Well, we were, oh, nice. That was something over there.
What was that? What'd you see?
Like a rock being thrown.
From the south?
Yep. Okay. He's ruining our interview. Knock it off, Wood Ape. So essentially we had decided we were going to attempt for our second time to go to bed, and we had gone inside, the girls had gone inside to the cabin to get ready. Brian had a radio, and he was going to do a radio check, and so I was busy bothering around, and he had called a couple of times.
What did you hear?
What was that?
I have my headphones in. I can't hear anything.
No. All right, never mind. It was nothing, I swear. This is really black over there. So, he had called a couple times and I had not responded. And then he yelled out, radio check. And I heard him. So I called back on the radio to do the radio check. And we verified that both our radios were working.
And actually, I yelled that really loud because I heard it actually echo in the valley when I did it. It was a little louder than I thought I was going to do it. But.
And I obviously heard him from across the room. And so next thing I know, I'm getting ready to go to bed. And Brian had realized we had moved our chairs over to a side area to protect it from any rain that we were expecting to come the following morning. And Brian realized that he had left his gun attached to his chair. And so he was walking over to the east side of the cabin. And when all of a sudden, all I can describe is at first what I heard was all these rocks starting to dislodge, and then I heard the very distinct cracking of a tree coming down like it was being pushed over. And I heard Brian yell out, tree!
Something. I don't know what I said. It's something to do with a tree.
I heard, Mommy!
I don't think I yelled, tree, but it was something like that.
And so we all of us heard the crashing noise, and it took me just a little bit to recognize that it was, you know, that cracking represented a tree. So I ran outside barefoot. I didn't even have my gun or anything, and we kind of just all ran out, and we could still hear the thing kind of clamoring down. It was still in the process of trying to come to rest someplace, and it just was very clear to me what had happened is Brian had... now, whether it would have pushed a tree down whether or not, right. But Brian's action of going to the side of the cabin while the rest of us were inside safe, I think was very intimidating to what was on the hillside already watching us. And so its reaction was one of display, which you would expect an ape, a chimp, or a gorilla to do to try to intimidate the dominant male that was encroaching on its territory. And so had Brian... not gone and gotten his gun, would it have happened? We don't know. Was there an imaginary line that those wood apes have that they don't want anybody crossing? Probably yes. Had a female done it, would they have reacted the same? Probably not. And so as an anthropologist, when you see something like that that is so classic to well-documented ape behavior, I mean, it just makes you just go, uh-huh, that's what we've been saying, that's ape behavior. And it doesn't mean that even though we recognized that it was a display, that it was any less intimidating. I mean, for sure. I mean, it was just like, ah, because then all of us slept in the cabin. Nobody slept in a tent.
The tents were off limits at that point. So we had done the Sierra sounds, and then I had been making calls myself. Like loud. I was trying to imitate the barred owl. I wasn't trying to make like Bigfoot howls or anything, but I was making loud noises and screaming and yelling. And so the situation that we had had here for the past couple of days, it was myself and four women. So I don't know, this is all speculation, right? But if you're looking down there and you're a primate and you yourself have sort of a collection of people around you, of monkeys or apes around you, I don't know. Did they think that I was the dominant male? Did they think that they need to make some sort of display? I did feel that when I walked over there, I took a beeline right towards where my chair was, where the holster was slung over the chair. And directly above that is where the tree was pushed down. Now, I lit it up with my flashlight. I didn't see any motion up there, but it sounded huge. And you could hear it just like crack, crack, snap, 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 and then crash really loud. So, yeah, I felt that it was aimed at me. Monica, you were in your tent when you heard that. What was going through your mind when you heard the tree come down?
Well, I knew, you know, immediately from the sound. The smoke's killing me, sorry.
Smoke break.
Yeah, it's terrible. I knew immediately from the sound what it was because, you know, I've heard trees fall before, and it was that crack and crack, 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 crash, crash. And I just sat there thinking, oh, I hope it doesn't hit the cabin. And then I thought, well, all that activity is going on the other side of the cabin. I'm sitting over here by myself, and I was fully expecting something to happen behind me, the area behind me, which is heavily wooded. And we have had activity going on back there. Right. And then you started yelling, everybody came out, and I was concerned because I didn't know where the tree had landed, so jumped out and ran towards the sound.
So if you're listening to this, you might say, well, okay, a tree fell down. Trees fall down in the woods. There's lots of trees in the woods, and sometimes they fall down, and that's true. And it seems circumstantial to us that the tree came down exactly when it did. The reason why I'm fairly confident saying that it's ape-related is as we... looked up there, Kathy saw, I think it was just the two of us, saw some flashes of orange eye shine. What are you pointing at? A rock just what?
Hit over by the tent.
Excellent. Excellent. They better not hit my truck, or I'm going to be pissed off. So we were looking up there, we saw some eye shine, then we came back to around the fire. And Monica, about, I don't know, this was maybe half an hour later, something happened. What happened after that?
Oh, the rock. Oh, my gosh. That was very interesting. It was definitely not a nut falling out of the tree, which is always something that we have to try to discern. Was it a rock? Was it a nut? It's hard to tell a lot of the time. But this, I could hear it actually, the leaves, you know, starting far away, getting closer, and then thud. It landed about 15 feet from the fire, which was incredibly close because so far nothing that's been tossed at us or falling from fallen from trees has been quite that close. So that was very interesting. And I was able to walk over and look right at what had been thrown.
Yeah, you walked right over there, and there it was. You saw the rock on the ground that had just landed there from up on the hillside.
Yeah, that was very, very interesting. I hadn't ever experienced anything quite like that before. It was very close, and I could hear the trajectory of the rock coming through the leaves. Right. Far away, closer, thud. There it is.
And that's when it's really compelling, is when you can hear it moving through the foliage of the trees, because then you get a sense of the direction it's coming from. And it did come from the direction almost exactly where we perceived eyeshine, and, you know, sort of in the direction of where the tree had fallen down. The other thing that happened sort of directly just after the tree was pushed down is there's another cabin to our south, and we heard unmistakable sounds of rocks hitting the tin roof of that cabin. So that happened immediately afterwards. I'm going to stop for a second because everybody's looking away and I can't hear what's going on. You saw a little eye shine up there?
A little bit.
Okay, cool. So that's, you know, essentially the sort of headline of the activity. I think that it was fun.
today
when the sun was up, it was fun. So the other thing that happened, I'll mention before we sign off here and pay more attention to what's happening on the hillside above us. The other day I was driving out, we had some people who were leaving, and I was driving them out of the canyon because they didn't have a vehicle that could make the trip. And as we were driving out, we had heard just before that, again, rocks, unmistakable sounds of rocks hitting the roof of one of those cabins over there. And it's different. You know, as Monica said, the nuts are falling. This time of year especially, the nuts are green, and the ones that are being chewed on by insects have started to fall. So you have to be sort of careful. But the nut sound is a sort of a lighter, plinkier sound. And when the rocks hit, it's a much deeper and more sort of noticeable rock sound. In any event, we had heard that twice in about 5 minutes from the direction that we were about to be driving. So as we were driving out, I was keeping my eyes open. We were all keeping our eyes open, looking in that general direction. And as we came around a clump of trees and one of the cabins became visible, I saw on the left side of the cabin motion. It was tall. It was taller than the fence. It was brown. It was taller than it was wide. And all I can say is that I couldn't make out a head or arms or anything like that, but it was a definite brown figure that was moving. It was in motion when I saw it, and it was over as soon as I saw it. It was a second long, and I believe what happened is that whatever it was moved behind the cabin and took off into the undergrowth behind the cabin. So I don't know what to call that. I don't know. I'm not going to say that's an actual sighting. I don't know what it was. It was brown, tall, and moving. So I'll leave it at that. So anyway, that's what we got here from Area X, and I'll leave it at that. And I'll just keep paying attention to what's happening on the hill behind us. Finally, I have an interview with the inimitable Daryl Collier, field coordinator of the NAWAC. Daryl receives and compiles each team's field notes and analyzes the results, so he's the guy to talk to if you want the big picture of what's happening in X. I reached Dale at his home in Waco, Texas. So you've heard the interviews that I did with Alton and Kathy and Monica, and it's interesting because over the course of just the few days that I recorded those, it seemed as though the activity level had been increasing. What's happened since the time that I spoke to Kathy and Monica, the interview that everyone just heard? What's happened in the couple of weeks since then?
Well, we've had what appears to be a substantial increase in, well, particularly in rock throwing.
Yeah.
The team that just came out of there, we refer to them as golf team. We've already put together the, what we call the after action report. That's a report that we put together, and it's based on the field journals of the team. So we've already put that together. We've already begun to do an analysis of the activity that took place there. And golf team, which was there for 1 week, had more rock throws during their week than any team prior And that includes all of Operation Relentless, Operation Persistence, and Operation Endurance.
So basically, like, almost 3 years now of these field studies, and they experienced just an incredible number of rocks.
Yeah, that's unbelievable. I mean, it's just incredible, unbelievable, ridiculous, really, is the way to look at it. I mean, as I was putting together the after action report, I thought surely it's going to let up sooner or later, but it was just. I mean, it was perfect for the name of this field study, which is Operation Relentless, because the rock throwing was relentless. Relentless. Now, somebody might question and wonder if we're, if we're falling victim to some nuts falling from trees.
Right, because there are nuts falling from trees in there this time. They're not ripe yet, but some of the raw nuts are falling.
Well, and the thing is that place is covered with hickory trees and black walnut trees. It's covered with them. So obviously, logically, out of all the rock throws that we documented, and we're not able to see all those rocks. In fact, we're not even able to see the vast majority of them. But you would have to assume that perhaps a small percentage of those are probably nuts. But here's the interesting thing: if there are nuts falling. And I don't say that all the rocks that they documented are rocks, but I think the vast majority of them were truly rocks. But if just suppose 50% of them were nuts, we've got a strange phenomenon going on, because there were very, 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 very few impact sounds that they recorded as rocks during the daytime.
Right.
So what we've got during the daytime, we hear. The team there hears a significant number of what we call wood knocking during the daytime.
Right.
And then once the sun goes down, the wood knocking subsides, and it's replaced with a more aggressive sort of sound, which is stone on metal, whether it's the cabin they're staying in or whether it's the other cabins in the immediate area. But the wood knocking almost all but disappears after dark, and it's replaced by banging on metal or rocks, or rock impact noises on metal. So, you might be able to argue somewhat that they're mistaking some nuts falling for rocks. But mm-hmm. I don't see how, because for one thing, they tested the differences.
Yeah, I mean, you would expect the nuts to fall all day long, you know. Yeah, I mean, right. That's your point, right? I mean, the nuts are only
Absolutely.
Falling if you want to take sort of the most skeptical point of view, then you'd have to come up with an explanation as to why nuts only fall during the night and they don't fall during the day, because we don't hear them during the day. When I was in there, the nuts would fall, and the thing is, you learn to tell the difference, because the sound of a little nut, a little woody piece of vegetable matter hitting a tin roof is one thing. And whenever I heard that, even though those things could have been also thrown by whoever or whatever was throwing the rocks, you can't know for a fact where it came from. So you'd have to discount that. But when a rock hits a metal roof, that's a very different sound.
Right. And our team tested that, because they wanted to be able to put that question to rest. So, well, first of all, what they do roof sweeps almost every day or every other day. And they found on the roofs of the structures, they found a significant number of rocks, some were the size of large coins, and then some, interestingly, were the size of beans.
Small
so,
rocks.
Yeah, very, very small rocks are being thrown as well. So that they tested the difference between the small bean-sized rocks and the hickory nuts and the black walnuts, and they sound the same, but there's a pretty good difference in that the rocks don't roll, the nuts roll.
Right.
So they sound the same when they hit these nuts and these very small rocks, but it's the after effects of the nuts or the rocks that allows you to tell the difference. And here's the thing here. I'm reading straight from our after action report here. Okay, we've got this is in the early morning hours of Wednesday, the 12th of June. our team has been subjected to rock throwing ever since the sun went down. They've gone to bed. Let's see, what time did they go to bed here? They went to bed at 0300, 3 a.m. Okay, 3 a.m. they go to bed. 309, they documented another rock hitting the roof of the cabin. 321, another rock strikes the base camp cabin metal roof. 343, yet another rock hits the base camp cabin roof. 349, rocks, plural, continue to strike the roof of the base camp cabin. 507, Hayes wondered if the apes ever rested as another rock hit the 10 base camp cabin roof. 536, with the sun just minutes from rising, another rock pops the cabin roof. Now, guess what? They stop right there. The sun is coming up. The rocks stop.
Right.
It's not until... I'm just scanning here. It's not until... I'm trying to look for the next rock throw.
It's not until much later, then.
11 o'clock the next night.
Right.
So there you go. No nuts fell from the time the sun went up till a couple of hours after the sun went down. And then, if you want to think for nuts, go ahead. But the nuts start falling again
right.
at 11 o'clock the next night.
Right.
They continue until 0600 the next morning. The rock throws cease at 0600 just as the sun is coming up. They hear another one at 10:26. They don't hear any more rocks until the next night after 9 p.m. There you go.
So there's definitely a correlation between this activity that we're observing and whether or not there's daylight, which doesn't make sense if you're trying to subscribe to the nut theory. So it's interesting. What's different this year? As I had talked earlier with Alton and Kathy, things seemed to be slower at the beginning of the operation, where in years past we had had activity in the second week where we had had some pretty intense things happen. I know I was there last year in the second week and had some interesting things happen, but that isn't really what we've seen this year. Sort of give us just an idea of how the profile of activity has been different.
Well, we have a sense environmentally that things have changed. I think everybody that's participated so far this year, we're into our eighth team right now.
Right.
A hotel team is out there now. So we're into our eighth team. Everybody that participated in the first 4 to 5 weeks agreed pretty much to a person that spring, that conditions, environmental conditions seem to be late.
Right.
Seems to be a late spring. It was very much definitely a wetter spring than it had ever been since we've been going in there. I don't remember. I've been going in there for a decade. I don't remember a wetter spring than this year.
Just unbelievable amounts of rain.
And unbelievable
day after day after day of it.
Yeah, inundated.
Right.
And it was pretty cool late into the year this year. I was part of the first team this year, and we only started a week earlier than we did last year, which in retrospect we probably should have done. But anyway, I was with the first team. It was downright chilly
that
first week. And I think it was probably that way the second week as well. I mean, you were there for the second team.
Yeah, it was much colder. I mean, comparing the two Bravos, Bravo Persistence and Bravo Relentless, there was a weak shift, but the foliage was maybe 70% what it had been a year before. I was, needing to wear a jacket much more often. It was much cooler. And as we had said, much wetter, though that week wasn't as bad as my second week in there. That was a really wet week. I mean, just, I bet we had 10 inches of rain that week. Unbelievable amounts of water. So really and I remember, the week that I was in there for Bravo this year, I came out thinking, well, a few things had happened, but it wasn't as eventful. But it really in the past couple of weeks seems to have picked up quite a bit.
Yeah, I think Echo Team, I was part of Echo Team. I think Echo Team is really sort of the turning point.
Like the hinge, right.
Yeah. Here's the thing. I mean, it's not been, I would not classify the first 4 weeks as dead at all. I mean,
right,
I think,
right.
I think, and the reason, and the,
right.
Yeah, the reason I say that is because we're coming out of Operation Persistence, which was just incredible.
Right.
And so I think we're a little bit desensitized. we're a little bit numb to what's going on out there.
Yeah.
I think if you brought somebody in that was totally fresh and had never experienced any of this before, I think they'd be blown away,
right,
no matter which team they went in with. But comparatively speaking, to say Bravo, Alpha, Bravo, and Kilo, I think were really the most had the most activity last year. Compared to those three teams, we're just now, we've just in the last two to three weeks started seeing that sort of
right
high level of activity. And I can't account for it other than, you know, maybe perhaps, and I'm not a biologist, so, but just from what, just my experience as an outdoorsman and just from what I've experienced, it's maybe environmental conditions. But there's also another factor. Kathy Strain, she's in her third week now.
Mm-hmm.
And coincidentally, things started to pick up really a little bit before Kathy got there. But when Kathy got there, and I'm not saying that she's the
she's the ape whisperer, right?
But I mean, it is what it is, right?
Right.
I mean, Kathy was on Foxtrot team. She's on Echo, or I see Foxtrot and Golf, which. And we haven't heard from Hotel, so we don't know what's going. We don't know what's been going on out there for the last several days. She's been out there with Hotel team. All I know is that Foxtrot and Golf were the two most active teams. I think probably other. I think Alpha would have been third. I'm just kind of guessing here.
Yeah, we haven't done all the crunched all the numbers yet, but I think you're probably right. And Foxtrot, I was on the Foxtrot team, and it was almost as active as we had experienced last year in the second week. Just a different texture of things, but besides the rocks, what kinds of, we had a member with a clear daylight sighting. We've had just one of those this year, right?
Yeah, we've had one very clear sighting. And
right.
We've had a few others that were
maybe
likely sightings.
Right.
And in the first week, I actually had a very possible sighting. I don't know what else that could have been, but I did not get a clear enough visual to be able to say definitively that's what I saw, but circumstances lead me to believe that's what it was. And the way these things look, the color of these two animals that I saw, and just the way things happened. I mean, we had just heard a large rock hit one of the cabins, and so I went over there to investigate, and I saw two large charcoal animals through gaps in the vegetation running along the bank of the creek. And one appeared upright. The other, the one behind it, appeared more horizontal. They were fast. They were large. One cut across the creek. They cut across the creek. I could hear them splashing.
You can hear it, right.
I could hear their feet splashing in the water. So that happened. And so then I went to the east, because I lost them. I went after them. Once I saw them, I attempted to pursue them, but I was not successful. They got away. So then I went back in the direction from where I thought these things had come, thinking they might double back, because we have some experience where that seems to have happened in the past. So I went east. I went east, probably 150 yards to the east. Meantime, Paul Bowman and Bob Strain are looking in the area where I had just come from, and
right.
Paul Bowman saw a brownish upright figure from about 80 yards away walking to the west. His first instinct was that he was seeing me, but he watched it for 5 or 6 seconds, and it had classic arm swing. He said it had a pointed head. It was dark. The animal was dark, dark brownish.
Right.
He described the face sort of like a mottled color.
And he had a uniform color. I mean, he had like the head, the shoulders, the chest. Well, the chest was darker, but the head and the shoulders was all sort of one sort of brownish color that clearly was not, that didn't match the description of anyone who was there.
Yeah, right. He thought at first it was me, but then when I came from the east, he knew right then and there that
right.
what he had seen was not me, and he had some difficulty dealing with it. He had not had a visual encounter before that, and as with most people, when they first see one, it sort of shocks them. No matter how much they've convinced themselves in the past that these things exist, once you have that visual, it really, really, reality really settles in, and you have to deal with it for a little bit, I think. And Paul was like that.
What's interesting to me about his experience is that it sort of illustrates two points, and that if you're interested in collecting the specimen that the NAWAC feels needs to be collected, that a lot of people besides us feel that need to be collected to establish this animal as real, so that we can actually begin the work of conservation. If you're interested in doing that and you have not yet seen one before, it's a very tricky thing, because when you see one like he did, it looks like a person. Your brain tells you it's a person, and so you therefore don't want to shoot at it, right?
Right. Right. Especially at distance.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, he believes it was probably 75 yards away, 80 yards away, and plus he knew I was in that area, so
sure.
He thought I might be downrange, and so yeah, I mean it. You want to make sure, you definitely want to make sure. And he, although what he saw did not, it did not appear to be me, it's still his first thought in his mind is, am I seeing Daryl? Is that
right?
Doesn't look like Daryl, but Daryl was down there. And he said he was really expecting, in his mind, I guess he had this scenario already, laid out in his mind that
right.
It would be sort of this classic, Patterson-Gimlin animal, Patty,
right.
Walking and very clear to see and all that. And he didn't have that. I mean, he said it was not that thick. It was thinner than that,
right.
It's
interesting because Kathy said the same thing in the interview I had with her, is that you, so many of us have seen that figure so many times that that's what your brain is expecting, and what we found is that for the most part, at least the animals that we're seeing, there's only one that seems to clearly fit that description. The rest of them have a different body shape altogether.
Definitely the one that we refer to as Old Gray, or mm-hmm. the large gray one. I mean, that thing looks just like Patty's sister or brother. I'm telling you, I saw it on the creek, but McClurkin saw it for several seconds at a distance of about 20 yards
right.
at night.
Right.
I don't know if the listeners have heard about this encounter, but this is last September or August. McClurkin went in there. He and Alex Diaz arrived at about midnight. They had just been there for a few short minutes. I think he'd only been there 5 or 10 minutes.
They were still unloading. Yeah, they were still unloading the truck.
Yeah, Alex had taken a load into the cabin. Mark McClurkin was standing outside by his truck. He heard some rocks kick behind him. He turned around, he turned his head map on, and there was this big gray one about 20 yards away just standing there, just looking at him. And he was, he stood there and just looked at it, and it stood there, and after about 4 or 5, 6 seconds, it just turned around and walked off into the darkness, not in a hurry. It
No.
didn't seem like it was threatened. It did not threaten him. And it was not at all scared or intimidated of him. I mean, it was very confident. And his description was more detailed than mine. And I had already said that I thought it looked very much like Patty. And then when he saw it, he got a much better look at it than I did. He said, absolutely, it's a spitting image of Patty, but it's gray from top to bottom.
And he said that it was thick all the way down, just the way she is.
Huge.
She was.
Yeah. Every bit of 8 feet tall.
And what's interesting to me about that, and we touched on this with Alton in the conversation I had with Alton, is that some of the animals are very reluctant to be seen and seem to be expending an awful lot of energy to move quickly so that they aren't. But ones like this one are almost purposefully not expending a lot of energy. Like there's like, yeah, I know you saw me, so what? And they just sort of walk off, but they're not running off. They're, I mean, this one has, I don't know that we've ever seen this one moving very quickly. It seems to have this attitude of like, I'm not going to make a big show of leaving right now. I'm just going to basically do it in my own sweet time. It's interesting to see the different personalities almost of the way these animals act around us.
Yeah. I mean, some of us have this theory that this one we refer to as Old Gray may be patriarch or matriarch,
right?
And I think it doesn't bow to anything,
right?
It doesn't have to. I mean, when I saw Gray, it was definitely not moving quickly. I mean, it just stepped up on the the big rock and stepped up on the bank very casually and was gone.
What's interesting, you know, and this is, and I'm clearly not a primatologist. I went to the zoo the other day, so I'm like, I didn't even stay at the Holiday Inn, so I'm not that big of an expert. But we were at the Como Zoo here in Minneapolis, or over in St. Paul, actually. They have a new primate. They've redone their primate exhibit, and they have a exhibit with some orangutans in it. And what I found interesting is there's four orangutans in there, and three of them came outside, and they were sort of, you know, two of them were playing, one of them was just sort of hanging out, and then the big one came out, and it was a female, and she moved very slowly, very sort of purposefully. The other ones got out of her way. She didn't look threatening, but she was really, really big. And it was, and what struck me at the time was that she's acting the way that I think about Old Gray, about the way that one doesn't move in a big rush. It seems like it just waits for the world to get around it, you know? So it very, and we don't know, but based on our observations, I think it is a safe assumption that that one seems to be pretty near the top of the pecking order.
Yeah, absolutely. Now we say that, but this year there seems to be a little bit of a different dynamic, and that is they're being very stingy with their appearances this year.
Yes.
We've had one clear one. We've had a few others that were possible or even probable. I mean,
right.
Urine Scanner, I think, was more than likely one of these apes. You had heard banging on one of the cabins. You got in your truck to drive out, and you scanned the area, and then you saw an upright brown figure twice as tall as the fence duck away or move away very quickly after the cabin had just been rocked or just had... There were a couple of rocks that had just been thrown at that cabin.
I don't know what else it could have been.
Yeah, absolutely. You see an upright brown thing, animal, there at the cabin, and it ducks away as you pull up. You didn't get a good look at it, but again, circumstantially, I don't know what else it could have been there.
Right.
Counting yours and mine and Paul's, now, one of our people saw a small brown tailless animal jump from the top of one tree to another tree. Now, my own theory is that may have been a young one. There's no tail. The animal was brown, uniformly brown. And the thing is, in 2004, I thought I saw something similar like that, but... I don't think I got as good a view as what this person got.
Right.
This person clearly saw the animal.
Right.
In 2004, I thought I saw something peripherally do that.
Right.
But this person was looking right at that animal, and so...
And we actually have one of the sort of quote-unquote historical sightings, one of the older sightings from the area from one of the family members who's been going in there, was of an ape-like animal up in a tree.
Yes, and one of our investigators last year... caught one up in a tree.
Correct.
Saw the arm wrapped around the legs, the knees sticking out. It was up the tree about 20 feet. And I know this is incredible for people to believe, but you know, all I can tell you is you know, we're just telling you everything that's happening there, and hopefully we'll be able to get that definitive evidence, and all this will then be taken more seriously. But one of our investigators caught one up in the tree. He saw it throw a rock at him from up in the tree.
Saw the arm swing.
So we have reason to believe that they do take to the trees, either to look to watch us, or to go up there and throw rocks at us.
And really, it's been since that encounter that you're talking about that we've started to pay a lot more attention to the trees. I know when I was going in there last year, I didn't really look up in the trees hardly at all. But since then, and what's interesting to me about that, and this is just speculation, of course, but what was interesting to me about that is that week, there was another person in there who wasn't a member of the group, but who had a lot of experience around monkeys, specifically monkeys, and actually raised monkeys. and when our guy said, you know, how are they getting the rocks up there? He immediately said, oh, they're putting them in their mouth. For him, it was clear that they would put stuff in their mouth as a way to hold on to it as they were doing that sort of thing. So who knows if that's what really happens? But it's
yeah. But I then don't... remember we had what we called the rain of rocks after that.
Yep.
or was it right before that? It was right in the same time frame, and we wondered how in the world could they throw so many rocks, one right after the other. I mean, it was just a constant barrage of rocks. It's just incredible. It's incredible to listen to it on the recording, but I want the listeners to know that it's incredible to be there.
You were there. Right.
I was there for three mornings in a row it happened. And people say, why don't you go after them? Well, we tried that. You try to get up out of the bed, you go outside, you go around to the back, and you hear all these big animals moving off in the woods, and you can't go after them. And it's frustrating. So then so then the next morning, you just lie there in the bed. Because, you know, when you get up out of the bed, you run outside. I don't care how, I mean, trust me, I have busted out that door more times than I can count.
Right.
And you run outside, and you can hear stuff moving off, and then you'll hear, as if to taunt you, you'll hear one of them bust a cabin that's 60, 70 yards away that you can't get to. And very frustrating, but that's the nature.
It's difficult for people to understand how thick these woods are. I mean, and they come right up to the structure that we stay in. And people are going to think, yeah, whatever, that's an excuse. Well, yeah, it is an excuse. It's also true, right? So if you're an agile forest animal and you know how to move, we can't sneak out of that cabin because it makes all kinds of sounds. It's creaking. It's old. It's wooden. There's no way for us to like tiptoe out of that thing without them knowing if they're paying attention. And I think that's what we've experienced. And then and I've been in the situation where activity is occurring. You want to keep experiencing it. So there's a part of you that says, well, if I try to get up and run out there, there's like a 0.5% chance that I'm going to see something. But if I lay here, stuff will keep happening. So you choose to lay there.
Yeah. And the only way we can ever get them, the only way that we ever see them is when they make a mistake.
Correct.
That's the only way.
Right.
We've never successfully pursued one in a chase. And we have tried. We've tried to chase them. We've tried that. The only way that we ever actually see them is when they make a mistake. When we're able to capitalize on their inability to track multiple people at the same time, or when they don't know we're there, which is not very often, and they walk out in front of us.
Right.
That's the only way. The other times when they're taunting us, when they're throwing the rocks at the cabin, when they're, doing all kinds of stuff around the cabin, you try to chase after them, and they run off. It's like a game. I don't know. I mean, it's crazy, but we're lucky if we see them.
Correct.
It's simple.
This year, you say they're being stingy. Or we're just not having as good of luck, right? I mean, and if that's what it is, if it really is, if a big piece of this is luck, I remember, it's interesting you say that about if they make a mistake, because I remember talking to Rick Knoll several years ago. In fact, he's one of the first podcasts I did was with Rick Knoll. And he said to me either on that podcast or at that time that people see them when the apes make mistakes. That's when you see them. And when I was talking to Alton earlier in this episode, I don't know, unless the gray one is okay with being seen, I don't know that they've ever purposefully shown themselves. I can't think of a time where that would have happened. So I agree with you. I think that when you see one, it's because they've miscalculated.
Unless the incident involving Mark McClurk and
was,
turned around.
That's the one I was thinking too, right?
I wondered about that. I was thinking about that a couple of weeks ago. I was wondering, I thought, I wonder if that one actually made itself
like you could hear me, right?
Yeah, I wonder if that was a message. I wonder if it was trying to intimidate him just by its sheer presence. I just wondered that. Maybe this one is so confident, it's so bold that it stepped out there and said, "Here I am."
And of course, all we have is what we observe, and so when we spend so much time, we try to connect these dots. But really, the purpose of us being out there right now, besides trying to collect a specimen if we can, is to just make these observations. Kathy made the point earlier in the episode too about how you just have to observe these things, write things down, and in time you can start to draw connections. And that's what we try to do because we're humans and we try to do that. But it's very difficult, even at this stage, even after being in there for 3 years and having all the experiences we've had, it's difficult to really know what the motivations are of these animals and what's making them do the things they do.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Now, Now you say all we have are observations. Well, we do have some physical evidence. We have collected physical evidence while we've been in there, but I think that's what Brian means when he says we have these observations. I mean, I've seen more track in there now than I can count.
Sure.
Foot track. I've seen more than I can even, I mean, I'm sitting there thinking, and I can think of 3 or 4 or 5 instances where I've seen the tracks, and there have been more than that. I mean, the very first thing that brought us into this area were tracks that Alf and Higgins found.
That's first trip, right.
Yeah, and that was over a decade ago. So these apes, for whatever reason, and yes, you know, I refer to them as apes because that's what I definitely believe they're apes, just based on our experience and what behavioral displays that they exhibit. These apes have been there for at least a decade, at least. And
right.
whatever reason, I mean, they're resonance there. They're found and determined to stay, and our presence there over the last 3 years, the things we've done have not displaced them. They're still there, and they're still there. As golf team indicates, by the way, I don't think I said, but we documented over 160 block throws during golf team.
It's amazing.
And that's just the next closest team was a team from last year that had over 60 rock throws. Just incredible. I mean, it's just incredible stuff that golf team went through. They didn't have any visuals.
And so, we have some of the rocks. I mean, to your point earlier, we sweep the roofs, and Rick Hayes, I remember he posted a picture for us to look at of many of the rocks that he had pulled off this roof.
Yeah, and what's interesting also about the rock throws for golf team is that there seems to have been more incidences of our people being targeted.
Yeah.
Kathy Strang personally had at least a couple rocks whiz by her body and her head. I'm talking within inches. Just whiz by her. Jerry Heston, he had to retreat because he felt that he was the subject of these rocks. I mean, he was the target.
He was the target.
And so he actually went around. He tried to get away so they would stop throwing rocks at him. Because every time he moved, well, another rock would be thrown. It would bash the wall right beside him, missing by 2 feet.
Right.
So you have to think about that for a second.
And that is a bit of an escalation. I don't know that we've. I haven't ever felt like I was specifically a target. I mean, and I don't know that a lot of us have felt that way. But this is sort of a change.
It happened a few times before. It happened to Travis. Happened to Paul.
Paul had that experience in the creek that landed very close to him.
Yeah, and when Travis and I were out one time, one threw a rock and missed him by a couple of feet. I mean, it was a big rock. But those were sort of few and far between. But these were all the same night.
Right.
Jerry Heston had a rock thrown, and he's confident it was thrown at him. It hit the shed, scared him because it just came out of nowhere.
Right.
And then he walked over behind the cabin, and then here comes a rock out of the woods in front of him again and bashes the wall right beside him. Well, then he decides to just bail out. I mean, he moves back behind on the other side of the cabin. So then Kathy becomes the target, and she has 2 rocks whizzed by her. Now, here's the thing. Now, these things are hidden. We can't see them throw the rocks. So take that into account. They remain hidden. They're throwing rocks, and they're almost hitting our people. I mean, I play baseball all my life. I don't know that I can do that at night in the dark from 25 to 30 to 40 yards away, concealed and stay concealed
uphill through
behind
the trees.
Dense vegetation.
Right.
Without the people I'm throwing at, without them seeing me.
Well, we've done it. I mean, you and I have both done it. You get up there where we believe they are, and you try to throw the rocks down, and you try to hit where they hit. And most of the time, most of the time you're hitting trees. Most of the time they're deflecting.
They've got to be fairly close. They've got to be fairly close, right? Because if they're not, then the rocks that they throw are going to hit leaves. They're going to hit branches. They're going to hit trees. These rocks are coming through, and they're bashing the wall. They're hitting the roofs. They're landing at the feet of our people. I mean, whizzing by their heads.
During Foxtrot, we had a rock land right next to the firing. That may have been aimed at us. It was very close when it landed. I mean, Monica looked right over and pointed and said, "There's the rock that just landed here. It's like 10, 15 feet away from us." So the interesting thing, one of the interesting things that happened to me well, to all of us really on Foxtrot, was the tree thing. Now, that happened again. Can you speak to what happened the team after Foxtrot? They had another tree incident that was very similar to ours.
Yeah, you know, we talked about that. Brian, you and I had a conversation about that because, I wanted to just pick your brain about it.
Well, let me take a step back. I haven't actually, what the listeners have heard so far was an interview and a conversation we had about it, but what they have not heard is that I did go up to find that tree. I did find the tree. It was due north of where I had been standing, just as it had sounded, but it was much higher up the slope. And what I found was a tree that probably had been at one point 50 feet tall in that neighborhood, about halfway. And the trunk in this thing was probably 15 inches across. I mean, it was a big, big tree. And about halfway up, the tree had been broken off, and the top half of this tree had died for whatever reason. The bottom half was still alive. There were still some green branches on it, but the top of it was dry and dead. And it fell up the hill. It sort of fell away from the slope. And so it left me sort of puzzled because it was surrounded by ape activity. We had seen eyes. One of our team members had seen eyes a head higher than the top of my truck. And then afterward, we'd had the rock land very close to us. We saw red eye shine up on the slope. So it was surrounded by what we perceived to be ape activity. So either, in my mind, it was an incredible coincidence that this dead tree fell in the middle of all of this.
It
was in somehow for, you have to figure out how did it do that? How did it push a tree over halfway up, 25 feet up in the air, the top of it fall down? So I was left sort of perplexed about that.
And what you just said is interesting, particularly in light of what we discussed 5 or 10 minutes ago about our cognizance now that they take to the trees, that we've actually seen them in the trees. So if you imagine for a second a 500-pound animal that climbs a 15-inch thick tree, but he gets to a certain point up in the tree, and he's up there because he wants to see you at the cabin below, and at some point the tree just gives way. It breaks because of his weight. That's a possibility.
Sure it is.
Another possibility is that it went up the tree and broke the tree on purpose as part of an intimidation display.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you and I had that conversation about it, and you did not recall over the past 3 years,
I sort of blanked that stuff out. Right.
Yeah, you didn't recall any tree breaks, from very few, from the last 3 years. Well, what I did is I went back and I did an analysis of the after-action reports for Operation Endurance, Operation Persistence, and Operation Relentless, up to your team, Foxtrot team. And what I found is that we actually documented 15 tree crashes all around the cabin over the last, since 2011, since we've been going in there during the time that we've been in there.
A long-term program, right.
And this is all, these events are all surrounded by other activity.
Right.
Rock throwing, vocalizations, a lot of different things that we attribute to wood ape behavior. So, trees do fall in the woods, absolutely. I mean, we see that all the time. But also, we know that apes manipulate vegetation for a given purpose. And apes like to exhibit intimidation displays. And so I think there's a good possibility that what you experienced was a form of that. Because it did scare you, right? It scared the heck out of you.
It definitely intimidated you. Yeah.
And I had a similar experience in 2006. I was in the Davy Crockett National Forest with my wife. It was about 1 a.m, and we played some very loud, we did some call blasts, some very loud vocalizations. Within 10 seconds, just like you, we heard the cracking of a tree, we heard the tree splitting, and then we heard the tree crash to the ground. And it sounded like it was right on top of us. We never found that tree. But that same, after that, we heard banging on metal. We don't know how they found metal in the Davy Crockett National Forest, but there was banging on metal. There were vocalizations, Woodknocks. At the time, I was not sure about Woodknocks. Yeah, yeah. But in hindsight now, in retrospect now, I'm positive that's what it was. So, you all had been playing we've been
call blasting the Sierra Sounds and one of the snippets that are on that CD and I'd been making some weird vocalizations myself, sort of trying to imitate and call in some barred owls because it's kind of fun when the barred owls come in and start making their hooting and hollering. So who knows how they were interpreting that if that's what they were doing. But the golf team, the one right after us, was golf, right? They had a similar thing where a tree broke, and it was half the tree again. It wasn't the whole tree. And in this case, their tree was healthy.
And they saw it. They actually saw it. They saw the top of the tree fall. I mean, they could see the top, I guess over the trees in front of them, they could see the top of this tree fall. They could see it break and then fall. And they went to inspect it and found that it was a very green.
It was green, right?
Tree. It was not rotted. There were no signs that they could discern of black bear. No claw marks.
Right.
Nothing up in the tree like a beehive with honey or anything like that that a black bear would have crawled
right.
up for. And again, this was right there near the cabin. I think this was actually closer to the cabin than yours was. But this was definitely, it was a green tree. And there was nothing wrong with this tree.
Right.
And it was a red oak. I don't remember. I think yours was a hickory tree. If I remember from the video.
I believe so. Yeah.
So yeah. So yours was a hickory. This other one was a red oak. And, I think yours had some signs of degradation to the tree.
It did. It looked like it had been, like termites had been in there. I mean, it was old and dead on top.
Yeah.
So this is what you play this game in your head, this back and forth, this ping pong of like, well, is it or isn't it? And at the time it happened, I thought it was. And then I found it and like, well, maybe it's not. And then, but then you think about it. But then this happens a week later and it's sort of the same MO, right? It's a tree getting broken off towards the top. But in this case, the tree is totally healthy. So
that's how the species remains undocumented, because everything they do, largely everything they do, even the way they look, can be attributed to something else.
Yeah.
Their footprints. Right? Some guy's walking in the woods and he sees these barefoot footprints out in the woods, middle of nowhere. They look strangely human. What kind of freak would be out here walking around barefoot? I don't know. Must be some hippie.
Some nut.
So those get discounted. And then the way the thing looks, you've got a hunter in a deer in a hunting stand. He sees this upright figure walk across the cutaway. 100 yards away, he thinks it's a hunter. You know, what the heck is the hunter doing wearing a big, long black coat in early November or whatever? So he thinks it's a human. They throw rocks. They make these weird sounds, but all of it can be attributed to something else. So,
right.
So these guys are getting away with murder right here under the very noses of us and science and they're just masters at using the environment to their advantage, and I can't stress that enough. I mean, it's just incredible how cognizant they are of the environment and how to use it to their advantage. They're masters of camouflage, at using
right.
their environment to camouflage their movement, to camouflage where they are, and.
Well, one of the things to your earlier point about how people may experience something and then they sort of discount it or they explain it off as something else. I talked to Bob Strain and this is after Paul's sighting. This was a week later. You know, our speculation was that if Paul had been out in the woods by himself hunting, had not been, looking for Bigfoot, he may have had that experience and done what you just said. Like, what's that guy doing out here? Like, why is he wearing a brown coat or whatever
Absolutely.
It was? I mean, he would have written it off in his head and he would have sort of kept going. He would have just kept doing his thing. And the other thing, funny thing is Alton has told the story of being out in an area close to X, not right in X, but not too very far away, with some people for entirely different reason, for a sort of like, ancillary biological kind of survey of animals. And they heard a very loud tree knock, clear.
Several knocks.
Super loud wood-on-wood sound. And some people in the group just completely ignored it as if it didn't happen. And another guy said, he looks up and says, fireworks? And then keeps going to what he's doing. He's like, no, it's not fireworks. But anyway, it just goes to the point that people, you know, my analogy is that there's little slots in your brain that are certain shapes, and you get these pegs and your brain just keeps putting them through these holes. And sometimes it gets a peg that doesn't fit. So it just sort of shoves it through a hole and keeps going. And that's what happened there, I think.
You know, and I don't know how they're able to, I don't know. You know, I don't have an explanation for how they can avoid field cameras. I don't know. I just know what I've experienced, and we had, you know, dozens of cameras. We had cameras here, where we are now, in Area X, out for 5 years, and we didn't get a single picture. How they avoided those cameras now, knowing what we know now, how they avoided those cameras, I have no explanation for it.
Right.
I don't know. I have no idea. I just know that there is something going on with them and cameras. They either because the cameras are associated with humans, which doesn't really make sense because they approach other things that are associated with humans.
They sure do.
Do these things blind them? Are their rods and cones and their eyes developed to such an extent that they can actually detect the infrared from these cameras? I don't know. I just know that we don't have a picture, nor does anybody else,
right,
with a game camera. And in fact, we don't even use them anymore.
Yeah.
We don't even use them. It's like, and when I hear somebody say, "Well, I'm gonna take some fruit, and I'm gonna go put it up on the ledge, and I'm gonna put a reconnaissance camera," I just laugh.
Right.
That's just like you're doing right now.
Well, that's a good idea. We should have tried that a long time ago. Oh wait, we did 150 times.
Go ahead, dude. I mean, you're just wasting your time. Well, it doesn't hurt. Well, okay. Yeah, you're just taking minutes and you're spending calories that you can be doing something else, man.
Right.
It's just,
right,
you know, it's
frustrating.
Crazy.
It's frustrating.
Because they don't work. I don't know why, but they just don't work. And these things are they're masters. They're masters. And they are apes. They are a very unique type of ape, but they are apes. I mean, there's nothing that we've seen that indicates they don't use spears. They don't wear clothes. They don't have their stuff.
Right.
You know, they don't. They make sounds. Right. I've heard that myself,
right,
with my own ears,
through
the window, right before one threw a rock and bashed the cabin for the 100th time. I hear footballs. Then I hear bam! Rock slams the cabin, and that's ape. I mean, it's just pure ape, man. What they're doing, they throw rocks at. Stole the playbook from chimps.
Right. And to my experience, people who want to ascribe sort of something beyond the animal intelligence to them haven't really done the research to know what even apes are capable of doing, because gorillas, orangutans, and chimps are capable of doing some really incredible things, but none of the things that we've experienced are outside the scope of capability for an orangutan, a chimp, or a gorilla.
Yeah, you know, if no one had discovered orangutans yet, just for the sake of argument, stay with me here for a second. Nobody's discovered orangutans. It is an undiscovered species that people are reporting that they're seeing. And get this, they're reporting that these orangutans are stealing their boats.
Right.
they're reporting that they're stealing their boats, and not only stealing their boats, but they're stealing their fish from the cages, and they're eating the fish, and then they get in the boat, they go across the river, and they get out on the other side. Now, people would be saying, "Man, it would just be saying you're nuts. That's crazy."
Right.
And if it is doing that, it's not an ape.
It's a forest person. Smart.
Yeah, it's got to be a person. It's got to be a human doing that, because that's too smart for an ape. Well, I've got news for you, people. Orangutans have been documented.
Yeah,
doing
they
that.
Do that.
They have been documented. And orangutans have been known to pick locks, to store.
It's my favorite story.
Metal,
it's my favorite orangutan story. Yeah.
Yeah, and
be deceptive about it. They hide it in their mouth. They're not just like storing it in there. They're trying to keep their zookeepers from knowing that it's there. Incredible stories.
Yeah, and chimps are known to collect rocks
for later use, right?
Yeah, and then hide a stash of rocks,
right,
a big pile of them,
right,
to use as projectiles against the humans who are laughing at the chimps while they're in the zoo. And so then the chimps throw rocks, and they throw their poop, and they throw rocks, and they've got this big stash, and they'll continue to throw rocks. we're seeing all of that
right.
behavior.
That's the thing that strikes me. The more I'm there and the more that I read the field journals of our people who are in there, and the more I learn about large primate behavior, the more parallels I see. And this also goes back to, I don't know why I'm talking about Rick Noll all night long, but Rick Noll said the same thing. He said at one point to me, if you want to know about Bigfoot, learn about gorillas. Because they do a lot of the same things.
Absolutely. There are some people who don't want to, they want to hear that stuff, but you know, again, I'm going to go here to Goff's After Action Report. I'm just going to read you a couple of things here where they heard some vocalizations. See here if I can find this. Here's the part about where they found the tree that we were talking about. I'll just read this real quickly. Lawrence and Hayes hiked to find the healthy tree that the team had observed breaking at midday on Tuesday, 11 June. Lawrence and Hayes found the tree on the second mountain ledge, identified it as a red oak. The tree was indeed healthy and green. There appeared to be no readily apparent reason for the break. The team wondered if a large animal had climbed the tree and the tree gave under the animal's weight. While at the tree, the men heard a vocalization from the northeast. They described the sound as "hee-wah," similar to how a human might sound just as he or she were sneezing. That's one example. Here's another. Let me get another example here of another vocalization. It's a really good one. Freaky, but this is a unique species. It's an undiscovered species. It's all new. I mean, but definitely unique, and it's North American. It's not African, so this species would have evolved differently, would have evolved with its own sort of unique characteristics.
Right.
Let's see, where is it? Oh, barking. We've heard some barking sounds there. I heard the barking sound. Before I saw the two charcoal animals and before the rock bashed that cabin, we all heard it sounded like a barking sound. And here Travis talks about in this After Action Report how he heard he had a rock thrown at him from up in a tree. It came from up in a tree. And then when he pursued that, there was a strange, the way he described it, was a strange, deep, but loud barking sound from the east. So he thought it was trying to divert him away from the first tree. Now, where is that vocalization? Here we go. Okay. Now, these guys have been another rock thrown into camp. Another rock thrown into camp. Cathartically, Hayes and Lawrence unloaded. They threw about 20 rocks, right, one right after the other, into the middle woods and onto the mountainside. This is another rock war. The golf team had several rock wars with these things during their week. Now, 22:35, this is on a Friday night, Strain, Hayes, and Lawrence heard a very bizarre vocalization from what we call the middle woods. They described it as a deep, growling, almost pant hoot type of vocalization. And according to Lawrence, who heard it the best of the three, sounded almost like a deep, maniacal pant hoot. That's the way he described it. He said it was really loud and sort of echoed through the woods. Lawrence continued to throw rocks as a diversion. Hayes immediately and quickly ran around the middle woods to observe the middle woods from the south, but he wasn't able to see the animal. Really strange stuff, man. But again, very ape-like, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, we remarked when you and I were there a couple of years ago and we heard the pant hoot, which sounded just like, if you do a Google search for pant hoot, you're going to hear what you and I heard.
Have you and I ever talked? Has that ever been discussed on the Bigfoot Show?
I believe it has. I believe I brought it up. I think so. But you and I and another member were in very near where our the cabins are that we operate out of. And we heard a pant hoot. And again, it just, you can hear what this sounds like yourself. Press pause on your media player here. Go over to the YouTube, search chimpanzee pant hoot, and the first thing you're going to hit is very similar to what you and I and this other member heard. And we remarked
deeper,
at the time.
Right? Deeper. It was bigger and deeper.
Yeah.
Did you agree?
Yes. And it was very loud. And what was interesting in what we heard is it sort of at the end, there were a bunch of coyotes that were yipping and yapping at the end, and then there was coyotes whining. So almost like the coyotes, something bad happened to a coyote, I think.
Absolutely. And you know what's cool about that is that I didn't realize until later on. I think you sent this to me, or somebody did, about Les Stroud. you heard something that sounds very similar to what you and I heard.
Right.
Now, I caught the tail end of it. You and McAndrews were standing outside my truck. We had been clearing a path through the woods because there were these three huge logs across the trail. And so we had to cut these smaller trees so we could drive, you know, right. and get back to the cabin. And you two were standing out, and I remember looking at you. I started up my truck engine, and I'm pulling my truck through this little narrow gap that we'd cut. We'd been sawing these trees for 30 minutes or so. And I looked at you in the rearview mirror, and you're doing your hand across your neck like, you know, if you were emphatic, desperate, like, stop, kill it, kill it. And I killed my engine. I got out, and I heard this most god-awful sound. And, you know, I'm going to try to do it for you, but...
Well, you do a good job.
It was
that's what it was.
I mean, and it just kept on and
that's
on.
What it was,
I heard it for like 10 seconds, and I think y'all heard it for 15, 20 seconds maybe.
Well, you know, it was, at first I was trying to figure out if it was some kind of weird bird vocalization, and in my head I was like, is that a turkey? I mean, I didn't know what it was, but this is what you do, right? You experience these things, and this is your brain taking a new peg and trying to find a hole that it fits into.
Plus, my truck was still on when y'all
And your truck
it.
Was
when
on,
I
right.
turned the truck off, well, then it was just clear, and I mean, it just, and when I got out, I mean, the chill bumps went down my spine
right.
because
it was a
just,
freaky
was
sound.
Echoing.
And at the end of it, the coyotes were getting involved towards the end, yipping and yapping. And then when it stopped, the coyotes were crying. They were whining. So what my speculation is, because this is all speculation, that we had sort of like just heard this interaction between these forest animals, this coyote and perhaps an ape. But we remarked at the time that it sounded almost like laughing, you know, because that's what it sounds like. If you hear what a panhoot sounds like, it sounds kind of like a laugh. It's kind of weird.
Yeah.
Crazy stuff. I mean, it's a remarkable place.
And that was all ape. I mean, that vocalization, my gosh. I mean, it was like a chimp on steroids.
Really?
You imagine an 8-foot tall chimp, you know, that's what it sounded like. So
what happens next down there? We're continuing,
we're still continuing. Operation Relentless is that. I mean, we are relentlessly on this thing. And I'm going in, I'll be going in a week, a little over a week. I'll be taking another team in there, Alton Higgins and I, Travis Lawrence. We'll be taking another team in there, the team in the next week. And you know, we're gonna continue to collect. We're gonna continue to observe, and we're going to continue to attempt to collect definitive, irrefutable evidence that there is a species of North American, that there is a species of ape in North America. We're on it like a dog with a bone. I mean, we're just we're not going away. And and I want people to understand this. Well, I did a presentation about 3 weeks ago, and they asked one of the last questions they asked me. They almost wouldn't let us go. Once I got through with the presentation, they wanted to ask questions for another 45 minutes. And one of the questions was, how long do you think it will be before this thing is proven definitively? How long do you think it will be before your organization is able to prove it? I said, I don't know how long it will be, but I will tell you this. This thing could happen at any time, any day. Listeners of the Bigfoot Show, I want you to understand that. It could happen at any time. Any day, it could happen. That's not a promise, but it is a promise that it could happen at any time. What I'm saying is, I don't know that it's going to happen, but I can tell you that it very well could happen at any time.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I everyone, you know, not everyone, but people who know me personally have been asking me for percentages, like odds, and I don't know that I can give you odds, but I agree with you. I agree with you. It could be happening right now.
Here are your odds. We are there. There are apes there, and when those rocks are thrown, this is what I said to you the other day. There is an ape at the other end of that rock.
Right.
They can't be any more, for reasons I've already talked about. They can't be any more than 30 yards away from us when they throw those rocks. They can't be. So there's your odds. Now, they've got darkness on their side. They've got dense woods on their side. They've got this tremendous physical ability. They've got some very, very sharp cognitive skills. So, I mean, they've got some decided advantages. But we have some tricks up our sleeve as well that so far haven't paid off for us. But they sort of tilted back in our favor a little bit. The odds are good. The odds are good. The odds are good that we're going to be able to solve this. Some people don't want to hear that.
No.
Some people do not want to hear that, and I'm sorry for that. But, you know, I believe in progress of science. I don't believe in dogma. I don't believe in, you know, emotivism. I don't believe in that. I believe in progress of science, and this thing exists. Science needs to know about it. The world needs to know about it. There could be great benefits for humankind by discovering this animal. Great things we could learn about ourselves, about our history, about our past, even about our future, about our medicine, even. So it needs to happen. And you know, I've heard people say, "Well, why are you in a hurry? Why does it have?" What do you mean, why are we in a hurry? Because we're talking about the advancement of science, of the century, of the age. That's why. And we're talking about the discovery of the age. That's why it needs to happen yesterday.
And then all the things that I've talked about on the show before, about how we don't know what their populations are like. If you look at all the other sort of analogs of large apex predators, omnivorous animals, none of them are doing well, right? I mean, there's not one that you can point to that isn't being protected and purposely trying to be brought back. All of the ones that are out there have suffered dramatically in the past several hundred years. So there's no reason to believe that wood apes aren't in the same bucket and will continue along the same trajectory until such time as they're real and they get official recognition.
And here's a perspective for you. The primitive big thicket is estimated to have been, at one time, 1 million acres in size.
Yeah, it's amazing.
The Big Thicket National Preserve now is probably 100,000 acres.
Yeah, it's about that.
It's highly fragmented.
It's all broken up, right? It isn't one big
clump. It's broken
clump.
Up.
Right.
It's highly fragmented. It's surrounded. It's encroached. It's surrounded by development, by highways, by residential development, by cities that are growing. You know, I mean, to the south, 70 miles to the southeast, you've got Houston. There are millions and millions and millions of people in Houston. Their habitat is dwindling, and we've got to be able to do something to be able to save that habitat. Where we are now, Area X, our goal is to turn that into a national wildlife refuge.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, the last thing any of us in our organization would want to see is that entire area up there fragmented because of human development. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm all for human progress, and I understand that we have to be able to develop. We have to be able to expand. But at the same time, I'm also for, you know, the preservation of our precious resources in our environment, particularly where you've got an animal like this that seems to prefer large, wild expanses of wilderness.
Right.
If you go and you start fragmenting that, and you start logging all of it, and you start developing it, well, then where is it going to go? Maybe a family group needs 20. Maybe they need 500 square miles. Maybe a family group does.
I don't know. Right, we don't know.
And if they do, that's large, and that's got to be protected somehow. I mean, that's why. That's why the sense of urgency. Because this is definitely a serious issue, and it's critical. I think it's very critical. And if we can save that, if we can do something to save that and to keep these places like the Big Thicket, for instance, of being further fragmented, which would then, we think, help this species, then we need to do it, and we need to do it quickly.
Agreed. Well, Daryl, I really appreciate you coming on. I know that we've just scratched the surface of the things that have happened in there, and
we could
keep going for two more hours telling stories.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I do appreciate you you coming on the show and taking your time and sort of filling in the background of this year's Operation Relentless.
It's been my pleasure, man.
And that's it. All the X News That'll Fit in a 2-hour and 20-minute episode of The Bigfoot Show. Remember, we have a new website. That's where you can catch all our old episodes and leave comments and even help us create new show notes for a bunch of them by visiting thebigfootshow.com. As always, we're also on Facebook at facebook.com/thebigfootshow. And if you listen to us on an iDevice or via iTunes, please, please, please go to iTunes there and subscribe and rate or review us. It helps people discover our show. And with that, I will leave you until next time.